Welcome everyone. This is the makeup recording for the State of the Economy webinar that we gave on Friday, August 12th, 2011. What had happened is that the first 8 to 10 minutes or so of that, there was a problem, there was a glitch in the audio recording. And so in order to get people who want to hear it after the fact, to give them the smooth version, I'm going to redo the first 10 minutes of that, but then we have preserved the original take that I did on that Friday night, where you can hear me give the original thing, kicking in about 10 minutes, and you can hear all the questions that I fielded live. Also, for those of you who are joining late, you can also make sure you go to the Moodle forum thread saying questions for Dr. Murphy, and you can see where I typed in answers to people's questions that I couldn't get to during that live webinar. So what we're talking about is the state of the economy. I'm going through the PowerPoint slide. You can follow along. And first, we're going to talk about monetary policy. As the cartoon graphic suggests, I'm not comfortable with where Big Ben is taking us as far as Fed policy. So let's walk through some things here. Okay, first of all, when it comes to the stock market, which was the thing in the news that really prompted us, the Mises Institute, to offer this webinar because the stock market was just incredibly volatile. I think it's good to take a step back and just look at the history over the decades, and you can see that there was reason to be alarmed. And this isn't just 2020 hindsight. I personally, on my blog, and I know a lot of other Austrians, have been warning for some time now that the stock market is not a safe place to be, that, you know, if you're following particular things, okay, have your money there if you have specific reasons for what you're doing, but just retired people who just have 401k or something, that they should realize that this is not going to be a smooth ride, put it that way. And so what was the reason for concern? Well, again, just looking at it before we even apply any theory here, you see this is a huge dot-com tech bubble in 99 that then collapsed. Then was replaced by the housing bubble, which then, of course, collapsed. And then it was pumped back up again by a Fed policy, as we'll show more concretely in a minute here. So the point is, looking at this, it shouldn't be a surprise that all of a sudden the stock market is falling. That looks to be the pattern of what's been going on the last 12 years, basically. And so from an Austrian, just to explain this or interpret this graph from an Austrian perspective and show the difference between the Austrian view and the Keynesian view, the Keynesians tend to ask when things fall apart, what just happened? Why all of a sudden are people not spending enough to maintain full employment? And well, gee, if for some reason consumers aren't spending enough and businesses aren't investing enough to keep everyone employed, well, then the government needs to step in and run a big budget deficit to fill that gap of spending, until the silly economy gets back up to its potential and real GDP closes that output gap and achieves potential GDP. Right, so that's the Keynesian view. Whereas the Austrians, for them, the issue isn't so much why at some point does the economy fall into recession. The question for the Austrians is why does the economy go through an unsustainable boom period periodically that then necessitates a recession? Right, so looking here, for example, the question for the Austrians is not, well, gee, how come from 2000 to 2002 or whenever that thing actually bottoms out, why did the stock market fall so much? That's not the question. And the question is not, well, gee, why from 06 or 07, whenever that thing peaks, does the stock market all of a sudden drop so much? And then lately, for me, the question is not, What in the world, what's going on? Was it the S&P downgrade? How come all of a sudden the stock market's falling? For me and the Austrians, the question is always, what in the world made investors bid up stock prices to such unrealistic heights that then understandably came crashing down when that bubble burst? And then again, why did it get bid up so quickly and into such a height and then get brought back down? The same thing. Right? So that's the difference between the Austrians and the Keynesians. And here, you know, I'm not putting words into the mouths of the Keynesians. Paul Krugman, the famous Keynesian Nobel Prize winner who blogs and writes columns for the New York Times, he has said repeatedly since this crisis set in and other people were complaining about Ben Bernanke's low interest rate policy and saying that that had something to do with the housing bubble, low interest rates did, Krugman has said repeatedly things along the lines of, look, it's right now we're in this crisis and let's deal with it. And yeah, it's also an intellectual curiosity and historical exercise. We can look back and see what got us here and try to learn from the past and then not repeat those mistakes. But the point is right now we have insufficient aggregate demand. We need to prop up demand. The Fed's out of ammunition in terms of conventional policy because they're up against the 0% lower bound, so we need big government deficits. That's the crucial thing right now. We have to create jobs, bring down unemployment, and then once we deal with that situation, that emergency calling for our attention, let's go ahead and then, as DC economists, look into the causes of the housing bubble. It, from the Austrian point of view, of course, that's insane. That Krugman is just setting us up for crash after crash with that mentality because it's his ostensible medicine of low interest rates and big budget deficits that sets up the unsustainable boom in the first place and then leads to a subsequent crash. And what's ironic in the case of Krugman specifically is that he's on record in 2002 saying, quite literally, he was quoting Paul McCulley from PIMSO, but Krugman was clearly, if you read the context in which he quotes him, Krugman was endorsing the analysis. Krugman in 2002 was lamenting the doldrums into which the economy was sinking, worrying about a double dip, and saying Alan Greenspan needs to replace the tech bubble with a housing bubble. And then again, later in 2006, Krugman, a reader, wrote in and asked Krugman, did Greenspan do the right thing? And Krugman said something like, as I quoted McCulley back then, saying he needed to replace a tech bubble with a housing bubble, and so within limits, he may have done the right thing. But then later, by 2004, he should have warned about frothiness in the housing sector. Okay, so this is why the Austrians harp so much on the boom-bust cycle. And we talk about the fact that the way you stop recession is not to do something in the midst of a recession. At that point, it's too late. The damage has already been done. The recession is when the economy is trying to recuperate from the malinvestments made during the boom. So for the Austrians, the crisis that was really coming to the fore in the fall of 2008, we wouldn't just look around and say, what happened in the last 2 weeks that made this crisis emerge? We'd say, no, what were all these horrible investments that were being made for years leading up to this point? Why are all these major investment firms now on the brink of insolvency? It's because they foolishly bought into all these mortgage-backed securities. Commercial banks were giving mortgages to people who had no business getting such a big mortgage. Home prices were getting bid up to unrealistic prices that couldn't be sustained, and so forth. So that is the problem from the Austrian point of view, and then so you diagnose and say, well, why did that stuff happen? And the answer is not, oh, it's because of deregulation, that laissez-faire George Bush. That's certainly not the Austrian explanation for the housing bubble. Okay, as far as the connection between the current rally in the stock market and Federal Reserve policy, let me just give you some empirical verification of that, because before I threw out some statements saying that it was the Fed that pumped up stock prices recently, and I just want to show you that that's not just a theory on my part, that we can document that. So in this chart, we're looking at this blue line here is the S&P 500, and then the red line is the monetary base. So the monetary base, what is that? That is a particular monetary aggregate. Economists have various ways of measuring the money supply. And so the monetary base is what that includes is currency in the hands of the public, like green pieces of paper, $20 bills, $100 bills, and commercial banks have reserves. So it's money in the vault or electronically they have reserves with the Fed. So those numbers all added up is the monetary base. And the reason I like to use that as an indicator of Federal Reserve policy is that the Fed directly controls the monetary base. Right, so regardless of what the public is doing in terms of its desire to hold cash or to keep money at the bank versus in their wallets and so on, the Federal Reserve has absolute total control over the monetary base, where some of the other things the Fed can only indirectly influence. So you can see in this chart, so here we got the stock market peaking in 07, it started dropping down in 08, bounces around a little bit, and then it just, you know, once those crises happen with Lehman and AIG and so on, the market just is in free fall, and it bottoms out in March of 09 and then shoots back up. And so what happened in this period, what you can see in late 08 is when all of a sudden Ben Bernanke engages in his unprecedented monetary expansion. And then it starts zooming up again. And here, the correlation actually, in reality, is better than these lines would suggest, because when this bottomed out, the blue line here, and started rising, that was in March of 09. And that was also when the Federal Open Market Committee had its meeting and announced the full extent of what we now call QE1. So that was the meeting where they gave the final numbers and saying, this is how many hundreds of billions of dollars worth of mortgage-backed securities we're going to buy and how many treasuries we're going to buy over the course of so many months. And so that's when the market stopped tanking and started rallying, is when the Fed announced, this is how many hundreds of billions of dollars we're going to create out of thin air and inject into the financial sector. Now over here, what happened in 2010, you may remember, going into the summer, the market fell and then was treading water, and then all of a sudden there's another big rally. And you can see that it roughly corresponds to the second jump up here, which was QE2. But actually, again, I would argue that the fit was even closer, because what happened is here in the late summer, the market starts rallying, even though the monetary base hadn't yet zoomed up, because as time dragged on, Federal Reserve officials who were in the know made it clearer and clearer that QE2 was coming after the fall election. If you think back and remember that, what was going on, the Fed was letting people know, yeah, we're going to do something. I mean, they weren't using the phrase QE2, but they were saying, we're going to buy more bonds. And then people in the market were just speculating as to, like, this was August and September of 2010. People in the markets were speculating about, well, gee, I wonder how big it's going to be. Do you think they're going to buy more than a trillion? And they said, oh, no, they might not do that, because the T word will scare people. They'll worry about inflation. So, but they'll probably be, you know, several hundreds of billions and so on. And that's what they were, it turned out, of course, to be 600 billion. But that's what people in the markets were doing in August and September of 2010, is they were just wondering, how big is that number going to be when the Fed formally announces right after the November election how big QE2 is going to be. And so that's why you start seeing the market rallying. So what's my point with this chart? It should not surprise you, if you are an Austrian economist or a fan of Austrian economics and you understand the importance of the sound of money and the illegitimacy of fiat money, the fact that our recent market recovery from March of 09 and then the second little leg there, since that was tied directly to Fed intervention, it shouldn't surprise us that once the Fed backs off, because remember, QE2 ended just a few, like a week or two, I mean, I'd have to check the calendar to refresh my memory, before the market really started tanking again. All right, so there was this confusion with all the debt debate and all that, the debt ceiling debate and then the stuff in Europe and so on, but it's also true that when QE2 ended, not shortly afterwards, the stock market seemed to be in trouble all of a sudden. And so that should give you pause. The fact the market now seems so closely aligned with Federal Reserve policy, that's a very scary thing if, as an Austrian, you understand that printing up dollar bills or electronically creating more money doesn't really make us wealthier, doesn't create real resources, doesn't create genuine savings. Okay, the next slide, interest rate signals. Here, what I want to get across is the fact that the Austrians are fairly unique among schools of thought in stressing the coordinating function of interest rates. That other schools of thought, for example, the Chicago School and the monetarists, the group that Milton Friedman really solidified, they also can be hawks on inflation, at least in certain circumstances. And in our recent crisis with the Keynesians arguing for more money being injected and for the Fed to do more, the Austrians, of course, are adamantly opposed, but actually so are a lot of Chicago school types. But there, typically the worry from the Chicago school side, or the supply siders in general, the reason they don't like loose monetary policy is they're worried about price inflation, which is perfectly correct. That is a good thing to worry about, and they're right to do so. But the point is, the Austrians take it a step further, I would say, and they realize that it's not just the inflation per se, the monetary inflation, then weakening the value of the dollar, driving up prices, which causes a redistribution of wealth and makes people's long-term planning ability weaker and so on. I mean, those are some of the problems with price inflation. Why is it bad? It's because it distorts economic activity and it redistributes wealth among various sectors. So that's all true, but the Austrians know that that's not the extent of the damage. The way our current system works up, our monetary and banking system, when the Fed lowers interest rates, buys up assets, creates money out of thin air to do so, that new money first enters the economy primarily through the credit market. So what happens is the prices that initially get bid up are short-term government bond prices. That's what the Fed typically buys. And so if the Fed were just being like Helicopter Ben's name suggests and is printing up money and just passing it around, you would see prices rise, but they would rise all over the place. Whereas if the Fed just injects $1 trillion into one particular sector and then that has to ripple out, well, then that's going to not only cause prices in general to go up, but it also would be distortionary because relative prices will get screwed up. Where that money first hits, you'll see prices going up there, and only over time will it ripple out. So when it comes to the way the Fed currently operates, and other central banks too, of course, typically when they inject a bunch of new money, when they want to lower interest rates, when they want to have a looser monetary policy, they buy government bonds, and typically short-term ones. So what that does is it pushes down short-term interest rates. And you can see here that over the sweep of decades, as I'm showing you in this chart, the interest rate that we ended up having under Alan Greenspan was fairly low. So it started out here, this was right after the dot-com crash. Interest rate started, this is the federal funds rate, which, let me just explain what that is. So this graph, this blue line, is the effective federal funds rate. So effective means this is the actual market rate as opposed to the target. This is what actually was determined by supply and demand in the market. And the federal funds rate, that refers to the interest rate that's charged on overnight loans of reserves among commercial banks. So a commercial bank, it has customers' checking account balances. So let's say it's Citibank or something, and you go to all of its customers and add up, you know, this guy has $300 in his checking account, this guy has $800, this guy has $2,000. You do that for all the customers, and let's say the number is $1 billion. So under the Federal Reserve's regulations, commercial banks need to have a certain amount of reserves set aside to back up its customer checking account balances. I mean, I'm simplifying, obviously, dumbing it down a little bit, but the gist is correct. And roughly, it's 10%. So if Citibank has $1 billion in total customer checking account balances, it needs to have $100 million set aside in reserves to back up those accounts. So that if people show up randomly to withdraw their money, Citibank can pay them off. If everybody shows up, Citibank is in trouble. That's a bank run. They can't pay them off because they don't have 100% reserves, but they got like 10% reserves, or they're required to. Right now, they actually have more, but that's a separate issue. Typically, they have just what they're required to hold. So what ends up happening is, in practice, depending on how many loans they grant to people and whether people show up and withdraw money or their customers are writing checks and so reserves are getting transferred from Citibank to its competitors and so on, it can happen in the course of business that a particular commercial bank has fewer reserves than it needs legally because of how many checking account balances its customers have, and so it's short, whereas some other bank might have more reserves than it actually needs according to the regulation to be okay, to be in conformity with the regulation. So the bank that has excess reserves will lend them to the bank with deficient reserves. And so the federal funds rate is the interest rate that those banks charge each other for overnight loans of those reserves. So how does the Fed push down interest rates? So here, the Fed funds rate was 6.5%, and then Greenspan, who was the Fed chairman at the time, had a policy and pushed it all the way down to 1% by June of 2003 and held it there for a year. So how does the Fed do that? Well, they go into the marketplace and they start buying assets, adding them to the Fed balance sheet. So how do they do that? How does the Fed come up with the money to buy assets, like government bonds, things like that? The Fed just writes checks on itself. And because it's the Fed, that's perfectly legal. It creates those reserves out of thin air. It just says, oh, you're selling bonds, we'll give you $1 million for those bonds. And the person in the private sector says, okay, here you go. And they write a check to that person, you know, to Joe Blow, $1 million drawn on the Federal Reserve Bank. Give it to him. He puts it in his own checking account, and now his bank clears that check with the Fed, and then that his bank has $1 million more in reserve electronically with the Fed, just because the Fed just changes the numbers in the computer. And now the Fed's sitting on $1 million worth of bonds. And Joe Blow has $1 million in his checking account. All right, so that's how the Fed does it. So you can see why when the Fed inflates, creates more reserves out of thin air, that tends to push down the Fed funds rate. It's because the quantity of reserves has gone up. And so now, other things equal, more banks have excess reserves initially because the Fed just created more reserves and dumped them into the system. So now they're more willing to lend those out. So the interest rate to borrow excess reserves goes down as there are now more excess reserves floating around. And of course, it's the opposite when the Fed wants to raise interest rates. They sell stuff off their balance sheet, and then people have to write checks to buy the stuff, and then the Fed, that just cancels out. And so now the quantity of reserves in the system shrinks when people are paying the Fed. Because the Fed doesn't, like, put that money aside. It just disappears. Because the Fed can create dollars that can destroy them, too. Just through accounting operations. So that's what happens. And at this point, I think I've caught up to where we were in the original recording on Friday night where we got after the sound glitch. So at this point, I'll stop this recording and you can switch over to the original recording that was done live on Friday. Thanks, everyone, for your support of the Mises Institute, and I hope you benefit from this webinar. How does it couch its policy goals? Typically, the Fed, at least before this crisis, looked at the Fed funds rate, so it had a target for it. So this is basically showing what the Fed's stance was in terms of wanting to step on the gas or step on the brake, if you will. So you can see here that here we are in 2000, when the Fed funds rate was at 6.5%. So just a review of what happened. So you got the dot-com crash, then of course you had the terrorist attacks in 2001. So Alan Greenspan starts slashing the Fed's policy rate pretty quickly. They keep moving it down, all the way down to 1% by June of 2003, and they hold there for a year. And so you can see, let me just get that arrow out of the way, just looking at the whole history there, you can see historically how low that was to have a federal funds rate of 1%. And then they started gradually hiking it back up. And then, as we all know, of course, once the housing bubble collapsed and then once the crisis hit in September of 2008, the Fed really started slashing funding. It had been doing a little bit earlier than that. Until now, Bernanke's pushed it down to between 0 and 0.25%, right, which is as low as it can go. And now the Fed has most recently, this week, come out and said, we're going to keep it there until probably at least mid-2013. So just extend that blue line on the graph out another 18 months. Right? So, from an Austrian point of view, what's the problem here? See, the mainstream economists, and we'll talk a little bit about this in a few more minutes, even those mainstream economists who are hawks on Fed policy, typically they think the reason it's bad if the Fed prints too much money or creates too much money electronically is that eventually that's going to cause price inflation, and they have some vague sense in which that's bad. That people, economists kind of know, yeah, you don't want prices rising by 8% a year, and you certainly don't want the price rises to be uncertain. So that really screws things up when people don't know if prices are going to go up 8% or 12% or 6%. That uncertainty messes up long-term economic planning. Okay, so mainstream economists know about that. That's not an exclusively Austrian insight. But what a lot of mainstream economists don't really get, in my opinion, is the coordinating function of interest rates. So in the Austrian view, the reason it's bad that Greenspan pushed interest rates down so much, and the reason it's so bad that Bernanke pushed interest rates down so much now to absurdly low levels, it's not simply that, well, to do that, they had to create a bunch of money and dump it in the financial sector, and eventually that's going to rear its head in consumer prices, and that your Coca-Cola is going to be more expensive now because of that. I mean, that's all true, but the Austrians, they know there's something specifically bad about creating fiat money and then injecting it through the credit market. In other words, if Ben Bernanke were going to just create $1 trillion and just hand it around, that would raise prices, but it might not cause a business cycle. But what does cause the business cycle is when they take that new money and give it to the bankers who then go lend it out, because that pushes down interest rates and it distorts the intertemporal structure of production. So I don't have time to recapitulate the whole Austrian business cycle theory here for you. If you go to my archives at Mises.org, obviously I spell these things out in much greater detail. But long story short, the interest rate is the price that coordinates activities over time. It, loosely speaking, it regulates how many productive operations business people start based on how much saving the private sector is willing to engage in. And so if people set aside enough real resources intending to devote them for the future, well, then the businesses can go ahead and start producing stuff that won't yield its fruits until years down the road. So the interest rate is the price that coordinates that. If there's less savings available, other things equal, the interest rate's high, and so that's like a penalty on long-term investment, right? Businesses are more reluctant to borrow money and expand their operations if they're not going to see the return for several years when the interest rate is 10% versus when it's 2%. So it screws things up if Bernanke comes along and pushes interest rates down to basically zero. He's not giving a shot in the arm to the economy. He's just making prices say the wrong stuff. Just like it wouldn't help things if Bernanke came along and started buying various derivative contracts in order to push the price of oil down to $5 a barrel. Yeah, that would temporarily push down gasoline prices, and that might make consumers think, oh, okay, now it's easier for me to drive, and that's what a relief. But as Austrian economists, we'd say, you're not doing anybody any favors. Gasoline is scarce, oil is scarce, and the price really means something. If the price of oil really should be $80 a barrel, market participants need to know that information in order to properly adjust their operations to take account of that real-world scarcity. And if you falsify that price, people will act as if there's more oil than there really is. And that's, you're not helping anything. You're screwing things up. So by the same token, when you push interest rates down to 0.25% or lower, or a particular interest rate, the federal funds rate, that screws everything up. You're not helping the economy. You're not creating more actual savings by doing that. So even though we haven't yet seen massive price inflation at the grocery store, like in terms of double-digit increases necessarily, so we'll talk a little bit more about this in the future, that's not the sole downside of monetary policy, of overly loose monetary policy from the Austrian perspective. So since the last few years when we've had this zero interest rate policy, I mean, this whole time, the economy has been without a rudder, as it were. As Mark Thornton, I think, used the phrase unhinged, that we do not have that coordinating role that the interest rate serves. that has effectively been neutralized. It's like Bernanke has taken away one of the things that helps guide the economy, and we keep wondering why this recession just lingers on and on and on, and why does the economy seem to be stalled? Well, because they're paralyzing all the normal things that the economy uses to recover and to get back on track. Okay, here's a, well, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but just to show you empirically that the Austrian theory is, does line up with the facts. So the Austrian story about the housing bubble was that when Greenspan cut interest rates, that really fueled the upswing in the housing bubble, and then when they started raising rates, that's when the housing bubble collapsed, and you can see that here. So this blue line is the 12-month change in the home price index, or the house price index, for nationally in the U.S. So here, what does that mean? And it's the right axis. That means at this point, about 12% or so. So at that point, housing prices were 12% higher nationally than they had been just 12 months earlier. So that was the maximum annualized rate of increase, or not annualized, but year-over-year increase in terms of the national averages. Obviously, in some local markets, the annual appreciations were much higher. And you can see that was, when did that real, this blue line really start taking off, was when Greenspan brought interest rates down to 1%. And then when did the thing collapse? Well, it's roughly after he started jacking up interest rates. And you can see that it's not a perfect mirror image of each other, but you can see how these, the blue and the red line kind of are mirror images, which is what you would expect from Austrian theory. Okay, the of course, really scary chart, the adjusted monetary base. And you can just see here how it's, I mean, just look at that. That's astounding. So this is why, if you think fiat money distorts things, what Bernanke has been doing has been insane. I mean, he has injected about, what, $1.6 trillion into the financial sector on net. I mean, he's done more and then sucked some of it back and so on, but on net, there's that much more injected. So it's, one way of putting it is to say, back here, it looked like, oh, Greenspan pushed interest rates down to 1%, Bernanke pushed them down to 0.25, so Bernanke is just 75 basis points worse than Greenspan. Well, no, because once you get down to that low level, you can't really push interest rates down much more. So you can see here, I mean, look at this, is this little blip right there in the monetary base was the preparation for Y2K, that Greenspan flooded the markets with extra money to make sure there were no problems cashing checks and stuff going to the Y2K incident. And then when that went off without a hitch, he sucked some of that out. You can barely even see that little ripple because now the scale of this graph has to be large enough to accommodate what Bernanke's done in just the last 3 years. Okay, so because of charts like that, people like Peter Schiff and myself and a few other, not all Austrians, some of them were saying, no, there's deleveraging forces that are offsetting it, but a lot of us have been very concerned about price inflation, and people are making comparisons to interwar Germany, people with wheelbarrows of cash, and talking about Zimbabwe where, you know, you need $100 billion to buy some eggs. So let me just very quickly run through why haven't we seen that yet? You know, what's going on? With Bernanke doing what I just showed you in that chart, how come we don't see gas being $30 a gallon, things like that? Okay, so one deal is, or one thing you need to know, is that when people talk about the money supply, there's different things you might mean. So that chart that I showed you a few seconds ago, that where it's going through the roof, that's the monetary base. And so that is actual green pieces of paper held by the public, and it's the bank's reserves on deposit with the Fed. So the monetary base does not include customer checking accounts. Whereas M1, what you're looking at right now in this particular slide, what does that mean? That does not include the commercial bank's reserves with the Fed. What M1 does include is the actual currency held by the public and the public's electronic checking account balances. So when you go to your bank and your ATM and you see how much do I have available, that number, if you take everyone in the economy and add that up, that goes into M1. And if you look at everyone's purses and wallets and so forth and add up how many green pieces of paper they have in dollars, that number goes into M1. Right? So those are different things. So the money held by the public, a lot of people look at M1 or a slightly broader aggregate called M2 to mean money in the hands of the public. That has gone up too. Don't get me wrong. You can see in this chart, but that's only gone up by about $600 billion in the last 3 years from the initial quantity of about $1.4 trillion. Okay, so that has gone up. I mean, you can see from the spike there that that's gone up a lot because the people are panicked and they want to hold more cash. But it hasn't gone up nearly as much, especially in percentage terms, as the monetary base. So that's one thing that's going on. That's one reason we haven't seen a total price explosion, is that the money that's actually in the hands of the public has not gone up as much. So how is that? What's the reconciliation? Why is it that Bernanke has apparently created all this money and yet this particular aggregate hasn't exploded as much? It's because those reserves are sitting at the Fed. Okay, so this chart is called excess reserves. So what that means is, the way our commercial banking system works, it's fractional reserve. So if a particular bank, some community bank, whatever, if its customers collectively have, let's say, $100 million in checking account balances, legally that bank needs to have $10 million in reserve, give or take, right, about 10%. They have to have $10 million either in currency in their vault or on deposit electronically with the Fed, backing up that $100 million in customer checkbook balances. So when Bernanke started buying assets and adding it to the Fed's balance sheet, what he was doing is electronically writing checks drawn on the Fed, and then when those get deposited, it showed the reserves with those banks going up at the Fed, and you can see how much they've gone up. But the banks aren't lending for various reasons. We can get into that in the Q&A if you want, but for whatever reason, the banks have not been lending that new money up. So even though historically excess reserves tend to hug the zero line, that normal times when a bank has excess reserves just sitting there, the bank, that's not doing the bank any good, so they lend it out to earn interest on the loan. But here, they chose not to lend it out. They just let those things pile up. So even though that's real money, that's legal tender money, and so people sometimes say, oh, Bernanke didn't really create money. Well, no, he did create money. Those reserves are more money than your checking account is, because your checking account actually is not, that's a thing that the bank owes you. It's not something the Fed owes you, right? So these excess reserves are more real money than your checking account balance is. But the point is, there's a sense in which that money is bottled up. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the actual price inflation situation. Now, of course, I'm not even going to get into, there's a whole literature on the official numbers put out by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS. And what I'm going to show you here is you don't even have to go to these alternate sites like John Williams Shadow Stats and so forth to get the real scoop. I'm saying even with the government's own numbers, the price inflation picture is a lot different from what you may have thought just listening to the news. So here's the official consumer price level. So this is not rates of inflation. This is the actual level of the consumer price index. So you can see here, it fell quite unusually, right, given this history of showing here, in late 2008. But then Bernanke stabilized that fall, and then it started rising again. And then you can see lately, it's been rising at a pretty steep clip. And again, this is just the raw consumer price index as maintained by the BLS. These are official numbers. The other thing is, if you don't look at consumer prices, if you look at the producer price index, again, I'm not looking at some whack job alternate site. This is from the BLS itself. This is from their latest report, June 2011, the 12-month change in producer prices of various categories. And you can see the further up the chain of production you get, the higher it is. So finished goods year over year are up 7%. Intermediate goods are up 11%, and crude goods are up 26.2%. So again, to repeat myself here, this is not coming from shadow stats. This is coming from the government. They're saying the price of producer crude goods in June 2011 was 26.2% higher than it was in June 2011. And it's in this period when the Keynesians are worried, you know, telling us, we better watch out, we're on the verge of a deflationary cliff. All right, this is just to give you a broader perspective of what's happening with the dollar. So this is a trade-weighted exchange index. It's basically the dollar against a basket of other currencies. So you can see it strengthened during the tech bubble years, presumably as people were trying to get into the U.S., you know, pushing up the value of the dollar. But then all during the Bush administration, the dollar just tanked. It briefly surged during the terrifying months of the financial crisis because everyone was rushing to treasuries. They thought that that was a safe asset. And so if foreigners want to get into treasuries, they need to take their currencies and buy dollars with it to buy dollar-denominated assets. So that's why the dollar surged. But since then, you can see it's come back down. So it's at the lowest level it's been in a long time. And presumably it's going to keep falling. So it may not fall against the euro, but that's for obvious reasons, right? So you got to look at these things relatively. Okay, this is a quick summary as to, if you ask me right now, what went wrong, why, as far as Austrians who saw the stuff Bernanke was doing and we were worried about price inflation, why has that not, well, there goes my alarm, okay, I'll talk just a few more minutes to turn over your guys' questions. Why did that happen? Well, because I think it was a problem of aggregation. That really, think about what happened. Bernanke comes along in the midst of this awful economy, creates more than $1 trillion, hands it over basically to rich investment bankers, you know, bailing out all the people on Wall Street and so on. Meanwhile, the average American is unemployed or worried about losing his or her job, house is underwater, probably struggling with a lot of credit card debt. So in that environment, you probably, you know, what would you expect to see? Well, at least in the short term, the people who will get all these, you know, trillions of dollars of new money, they're not going to go to the store and buy eggs with it. They're not going to stock up on eggs and bread. They're going to go into things like the stock market. They're going to go into gold and silver. They're going to even buy bonds because the economy is so awful. They just want to, you know, be diversified. They don't know what to expect. So in this strange environment where the real economy is awful, it actually makes sense in retrospect that you'd see asset prices and bond prices even going up, and of course gold and silver skyrocketing, but you'd see much more sluggish reactions at the actual consumer retail level, because if you're just trying to use an inflation hedge, you're not going to go down to the mall and buy a bunch of polo shirts. And so the stores that are in those industries catering to the retail customer, they obviously aren't seeing a huge spike in demand, even though Bernanke on one end of the pipeline is shoveling trillions of dollars into the system. Okay, just to give you an idea in terms of how bad is it, I'm not, be clear here, I'm not predicting this will happen. I am just telling you, just so you have a feel for the ballpark of these numbers. If the commercial banks weren't worried about, you know, their capital constraints and their balance sheets, but if they just lent out everything they were legally allowed to because of the reserve requirements, they could create another $16 trillion or so in the money held by the public. That's about a ninefold increase. So even if you think that that wouldn't affect the worldwide demand to hold dollars, you just say naively, oh, a ninefold increase in the money supply leading to a ninefold increase in the price level, well, that's roughly like $30 a gallon for gas. All right, so that would be if nobody did anything, we emerged from this slump and the banks just went back to normal and lent out all those excess reserves. That's how much money Bernanke has waiting in the wings, as it were. So that raises the question, does the Fed have an exit strategy? So I think partly why not everybody is panicked, and the reason that certain market indicators like long-term TIPS yields and conventional bond yields, and you can back out and get the market's expectations of price inflation, it's not predicting $30 for gas anytime soon. Right? So what's going on? Well, I think falsely, a lot of investors believe Bernanke's not crazy. And they think, yeah, he pumped in a bunch of money, but he's going to suck it out once we emerge from this slump. You know, they're not going to just let that money sit there and get lent out and cause prices to go up by a factor of 9. They're not that crazy. So I don't want to get into it. In the Q&A, I'll come back to this if you guys want me to, but I have an article at Mises.org called The Fed's Flawed Exit Strategies or something like that. Just scroll through my archives. I've talked about this, the various proposals Fed officials and others have given as to how the Fed can pull those reserves out before massive price inflation breaks loose. And I am very skeptical that they can do that. I think the only way they can do it is to crash the economy. And so since they pumped all that money in to bail out the banks, I don't think, if the choice is between the banks or the dollar, I think Bernanke's going to let the dollar take it on the chin before destroying the banks by sucking all those reserves out or by making interest rates on U.S. debt go through the roof by dumping all the Fed holdings to Treasury. Okay, well, if I haven't depressed you enough, let me quickly just run through the fiscal mess. So here, this is the absolute level of the federal government's debt level. So you can see right now it's up at the 14.3 trillion mark. And they just, you know, not a little bit higher because they raised the debt ceiling and resumed borrowing. Why am I showing you this? I just want to remind everyone of how quickly the government is digging us into this hole right now. As early as 2001 or 2, the federal debt was only $6 trillion. And yet, a mere 9 years later, it's now $14.3 trillion. Right? Another way of putting it, in just the last 3 years, one-third of our current federal debt was accumulated. Right? So just in the last 3 years, we got the debt went up by 50% or from today's standpoint, one-third of the total debt we got under our belts just in the last 3 years. All right, so you can see this is clearly a story about George W. Bush and Barack Obama, to the extent that you want to blame it on presidents. You can just see that chart and how fast that's accumulated. Okay, that's nothing, though. Those figures that I was just talking about, that refers to the actual outstanding Treasury debt. So the actual, you know, when the government runs a deficit, issues bonds, people directly lend money to the government, that's what that $14.3 trillion is. And some of that is held by the Fed and some is held by the Social Security Administration, that kind of stuff. But that $14.3 trillion in debt of the Treasury means actual Treasury bonds. It does not mean promises the government has made in terms of, like, Social Security and Medicare and so forth. So for that, people have done various projections. The numbers vary because it depends on the assumptions you put into the projection. You're looking at a 50-year time horizon and trying to figure out, well, how much are we going to have to pay in Social Security? What are we going to take in revenue? I mean, you got to make a lot of assumptions for those simulations. So that's why these numbers are still all over the place. But be that as it may, the government right now is in the hole anywhere from 60 to more than $100 trillion in present value terms. Okay, so we are treating distant dollars less than a current dollar, and still, you add up all that stuff, the shortfall. So I'm not just saying what we're on the hook for, but at least there's money coming in the door down the road to pay for it. No, I'm saying how much right now does the government owe to these future generations over and above what they're likely to take in from workers at that time in tax payments and Social Security contributions and so on. That shortfall right now is anywhere from $60 to $100 trillion. Okay, here is the CBO's baseline projection of the federal debt. So that now we're back to the cash accounting. So this is just like the Treasury's running deficits year after year, and the federal debt goes from, you know, 14.3 trillion to higher and higher and higher. So this is a percentage of GDP. So what is this? So this one thing's not too bad. Okay, that's not so bad. But what about this alternative fiscal scenario where it just keeps going up and up, almost getting to 200% as soon as the year 2035. That alternative fiscal scenario is when the CBO assumes the government behaves as it's done in the past. So, for example, there's the alternative minimum tax. And so that was a thing designed to prevent rich people from shielding their income through all sorts of special loopholes. But over time, regular middle-class families were going to be hit with this thing, and so the politicians always keep pushing it back and saying, okay, this year there's an exemption. If you're a middle-class family, you don't get hit with the AMT. And they typically do that year after year. And so that, so since the government's then taking in less revenue because they're taxing the middle class less, that means the deficit would be higher, other things equal. Other things about reimbursing doctors for a certain way, you know, with Medicare and so on, instead of paying them much less than they would need to break even on these procedures, well, that would cost more money. And typically Congress has postponed what's called the Doc Fix. Okay? So all that stuff, that's what goes in this alternative fiscal scenario. So what that's basically saying is if Congress continues to operate the way it's been operating the last few decades, that's the path that the federal debt is going to be on. And the other thing, too, is I've gone into these projections. They're not assuming any nightmare scenarios here. They're not assuming that interest rates go up to 20%. They're not assuming that the dollar crashes. This is just cranking out business as usual if we keep running these deficits. I mean, one way to put it, I converted the numbers from percent of GDP to actual dollar amounts. In terms of the nominal amount, from here for the next 10 years, there's maybe 2 years where they're not projecting that the deficit will be over $1 trillion. Or saying the other way, in 8 of the next 10 years, they're saying the deficit is going to be higher than $1 trillion. So it briefly dips down in like 2014 and 2015, then goes back up above $1 trillion for as far as the eye can see. Okay, and that is, you know, their projection. And again, this is not coming from some doom, gloom, boom report. This is coming from the government. Okay, you might say, wait a minute. But didn't we just have this massive austerity package with the Tea Party and twisting Obama's arm and holding the American public hostage because of the debt ceiling? And no, absolutely not. So this is the discretionary spending cap on that bipartisan budget deal. And you can see discretionary spending. This isn't even the stuff that, you know, the entitlements and stuff. This is stuff that they theoretically could control and cut drastically if they needed to. Look how much that's going up under this allegedly awful austerity package. Another way of visualizing, oh, look at that. The baseline before we had that Tea Party inspired budget deal was that over the next 10 years, the federal government was going to spend $46.055 trillion. Now, because of that budget deal with all those, you know, the knives are out, slashing spending, over the next 10 years, the government's only going to spend $43.655 trillion. And of course, these cuts aren't even going to happen. The cuts don't kick in until down the road when there's another Congress going to be in the office. But even on its own terms, that means over the next 10 years, the federal government's going to spend on average $4.365 trillion per year. Right now, spending is, I haven't looked at the exact, I think it's like $3.8 trillion. Okay, so let me say it again. With this budget deal, with, you know, those Republicans really drew a line in the sand to protect the taxpayers. The government, over the next 10 years, on average, is going to spend a lot more than it's spending this year when we're allegedly in the middle of this crisis, and that's why we're spending so much. All right, so I don't mean to burst your bubble if you're a big fan of John Boehner, but the Republicans are not in Washington protecting the solvency of the Treasury. Okay, let me quickly wrap this up and turn to your questions. So some prognostications on the future. Again, not trying to give you specific advice, but just general big picture thought remarks. I expect there to be very sluggish real growth, meaning there's going to be high unemployment, a lot of idle resources, with at some point sharply rising consumer prices. I think it's entirely possible the U.S. stock market is going to crash again, but that doesn't mean, therefore, sell equities and go into bonds, because I also think there's going to be massive price inflation at some point. So, amidst all these things, there could be a period where the U.S. looks good, but only because everyone's running away from Europe, because they got their problems over there, too. All right, so here, I'm not trying to say something that can be true no matter what happens, but there's three different things going on. That there's all these regulations, tax increases, I think, are just a done deal. I think those are coming. And so that's going to wreck the real economy. It's going to cripple the economy's ability to grow. But yet, on top of that, you've got all this money creation. And on top of that, you have Europe imploding. And so people might flee Europe and come to the U.S. with their wealth. So you got those three things going on, and that's what leads me to this slide. Now, last thing here, and I'll turn over your questions. Obviously, what I've said thus far, particularly for people who are retired, you don't have a means of bringing in more income, and you were just trying to live off your principal and, you know, for the rest of your natural life and then leave something for your kids. Obviously, what I just said is very depressing. I mean, I've been consulting with my parents about what do you guys do with your money, and, you know, as a joke, I told my dad to start smoking again just because I couldn't see how they were going to live off of that, right? So, believe me, I'm trying to be flipping about or whatever, just crack jokes, but I understand it's tough. However, let me just try to make you not completely despondent here. Let me just offer three things. First is, the top thing, what is this? This is a scene from The Untouchables. So if you're not familiar with that, that was a movie dealing with Prohibition era Chicago with the gangster Al Capone and then the people that were sent in from the government to try to bring him down. So it was a pretty popular movie in the United States. And my point in this is if you were watching the movie, and Robert De Niro played Al Capone, Kevin Costner played the G-man who was trying to bring him down. So if you were watching that movie, and like let's say I let you watch it for an hour, and then I stopped it, and I grabbed you, and I said, okay, tell me about the movie. What'd you think? People would be saying, oh, wow, that Al Capone, you know, he's vicious. He used a baseball bat and really took out some guy that betrayed him and da-da-da-da. And man, I can't believe they threatened the daughter of that government agent. And is he going to still pursue this, or is he just going to drop it? And all the corruption and the bootlegging and all these corrupt politicians. And, wow, Sean Connery. You'd be going on and on like that. You wouldn't say, halfway through this movie, those people lived in such abject poverty. How could they stand it? No. They drove cool cars. They wore fedoras. They had neat Tommy guns and stuff, right? So the standard of living they had back then, watching that movie, to the extent that it was historically accurate, it didn't seem like those people were miserable and living on the edge of starvation, even though this was in, I'd have to look to see when the actual movie was supposed to take place, but, you know, late 20s, early 30s time, you know, in the Depression, right? So as bad as things are going to get nowadays, we're not going to be as poor as people were in the 1930s. And even though in 1933, when unemployment is 25%, that was pretty awful. I mean, in general, Americans were still very well-to-do then compared to the broad sweep of history. So my point is, a lot of this stuff, when we say things are going to be awful, we mean, compared to what they would be if we had a free market. But in absolute terms, we're going to be richer than Louis XIV was. We're still going to be fantastically wealthy compared to the barons of old. Okay, so just keep that in mind that it's we're still fantastically wealthy. I mean, the market capitalism has given us a high standard of living, and these idiots in Washington and the Fed are going to make it maybe go down a little bit in absolute terms, certainly lower compared to what it would have been in their absence, but in the grand sweep of things, we're still going to be pretty wealthy. Another way of putting this is Jeff Hucker's thesis about It's a Jetsons World. So he's saying, think of all the things we have nowadays. It's like we have most of the stuff the Jetsons had, except maybe like the hover boots. And one way of driving home this point is to say, there was a thing that came out recently talking about this survey that went around and asked, I think it was undergrads, I'm not sure. It said to them, if you would you be willing to give up the internet for the rest of your life for $1 million right now? And most of the people said, absolutely not. And I think their choice was correct. Right? I certainly wouldn't give up the internet for $1 million right now. And even young kids for whom $1 million seems like more than it really is. Like adults, you realize, you know, it's not that if you save a lot and you work for a few decades, you can have $1 million when all is said and done. It's not that big a deal. But to a kid in high school or something, $1 million seems like a fantastic sum of money, and yet they would not give up the internet for $1 million, and I think that they made the right choice. I don't think they just didn't get the question. So in a very real sense, all of us right now are millionaires compared to people just 15 years ago before the internet was really a big deal. So you get what I'm trying to say here, I hope, is that the market keeps producing things and delivering it, and we just take it for granted. Like, we just take it for granted. I mean, you can pull out your phone and talk to someone with a video chat in China, where, you know, that would have been Star Trek material just a few decades ago. And then, of course, the last thing is, I mean, just look at the example of Mises and his contemporaries. Whatever we're going to go through, it's probably not going to be as bad as the Nazis chasing you down from country to country and grabbing all your stuff, and you have to flee when you're sort of an older guy and start life across the ocean because the Nazis are chasing you, all right? And what did Mises do? He didn't pout and say, this stinks. Well, I think he turned his life around and did some fairly productive things, we'd all agree, right? So whatever's coming, and I think it is going to be bad, it's pointless. It doesn't do anybody any good for us to wallow around and curse Bernanke and say, this stinks. I mean, it's not going to be that bad in the grand scheme of things, and we might as well roll up our sleeves. The last thing in terms of inspirational hope here message is to say, one thing we can do and we need to make sure happens is that if this thing collapses like I think it's going to, and a lot of other Austrians do, we make sure everybody knows why it happened. That we get our narrative straight and we let people know this is why it happened. And so when we emerge from the rubble, people understand what we just went through and what you need for a solid recovery from that point on. That we don't let it get blamed on the free market. Okay, let me now turn over your questions. Okay, Daniel Jepson says, in your opinion, is the slowdown in labor productivity growth in the 1970s better understood as a result of the adoption of a pure fiat money standard or a cause? Put differently, if we were to return to a sound money standard tomorrow, would we soon be seeing robust growth as Ron Paul suggests? Or are we simply approaching the fundamental limit of what can be done with current energy technology? All right, so you've got a lot of stuff going on there. The energy thing, I don't think that there is any issue of energy, an energy constraint on us right now, at least not because of nature or engineering. I think to the extent that there's a constraint in energy markets, it's purely political. There's various ways of illustrating this, but for example, when it comes to proven oil reserves, you might see statistics like people saying, oh, at current rates of consumption, we only have enough oil to last us another 22 years, or whatever the number is. So what they mean by that is they look out at the proven reserves, right? So oil companies have gone out surveying using satellites now and whatever, drilling test holes here and there and having geologists come in and give their expert opinion. And they think, okay, we've located certain deposits. We think there's this much oil there that we could recover profitably, blah, blah, blah. And so they take those known reserves and add them all up. And then they say, okay, that's how many billions of barrels we have in known reserves. How many millions of barrels a year does the world currently consume? You divide those two numbers, and that's how many years left we have. So the fallacy there is that oil companies don't go out and locate every last drop of oil on Earth. They locate enough so they know, okay, we've got a few decades available. And then as those things start getting drawn down, then you have the incentive to go find more, right? So it's like the six-year-old going to the pantry, looking at how much food is in there, and then the mom comes and, you know, takes some of the macaroni and cheese and takes some of the whatever, the bread, and makes a meal that night, and now there's less food in the pantry, and the kid looks and does the math and says, at this current rate, Mom, we're going to run out of food in 3 days. And then she says, okay, but before we actually run out of food, I'm just going to go to the store and buy more, right? So it's like that. If you give an example, if you went back to 1980 and ran that calculation, the world would have had something like, I think it was 29 years of oil left in terms of how much oil they had located in 1980 compared to the annual consumption of oil in 1980. They would have thought at the time, we only got 29 years of oil. We better quickly wean ourselves from oil and find some other energy source because this is running out. And obviously, a couple of years ago, we didn't run out of oil, right? That window keeps getting pushed back. Okay, as far as the labor productivity slowdown, yes, it's almost comical to me how many economists will look at the 1970s, and there's various, and you can play with statistics and do whatever you want, but one of the big things, Tyler Collins come out with a thing called The Great Stagnation, it's like an ebook or something, and so the economists in the blogosphere were arguing about that left and right. And a apparently, depending on which statistics you look at, it seems like for some reason the U.S. economy and the world economy more generally, just it was growing nicely, and then for some reason in the early 70s, something changed, and all of a sudden, it's like all these economies hit a brick wall. And it's like, and I've seen, it's comical to me. I've seen, like, Scott Sumner is this guy who's big on saying that Bernanke is, you know, has tight money and that's why we're in trouble. And his thesis was just that, well, you know, there were various technological inventions and so forth, and we just kind of ran out of ideas in the early 70s. And that's, you know, the earlier inventions and stuff had run their course, and there's no new good ideas, really. We already invented all the stuff that was really, like, the low-hanging fruit, and now we're just, you know, tweaking things here and there. And no one thinks maybe Richard Nixon going off gold in 1971 might have something to do with why the whole world economy has been screwed up since then. So that's my hunch that, yeah, I think that does matter, whether the world is based on an actual commodity money versus people printing money out of thin air. I think that matters, and that that's why you're seeing this anomaly of why is it that the world economy all of a sudden seems to get much more sluggish and to have these, you know, inflationary spirals and these jobless recoveries. And so what's going on? What changed? Well, maybe we should have listened to the Austrians when they said going off gold was a really bad idea. Okay, next question. Jerry Claren says, is Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Laos, Burma, Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Singapore, headed the same route as the U.S. and Europe? I'm not sure of the others, but I know that the Philippines and Singapore have central banks, and a lot of their policies are modeled after the West. Where is there a good source to look this up? I'm not sure. I'm by no means an expert in this sort of area, Jerry. What I will say, I've been doing a lot of work for one of my clients in my consulting business, and it's true from a supply-side perspective. Right, so if the kind of thing you care about is fiscal policy, like you know, taxes and spending and so forth, there has been a lot of good developments lately in Southeast Asia. They've been signing free trade agreements with each other, and you know, free trade agreements with quotation marks around them. It's not like a postcard saying all tariffs are gone tomorrow. Don't get me wrong, but lowering tariff barriers, allowing foreign investment or, you know, reciprocal investments between those countries, like trying to make themselves into a trading block to compete with the United States or Europe, where, you know, they don't have many barriers internally to the movement of capital and goods. So that's true. China, you don't mention China, well, because you're saying Southeast Asia, but I know China has been, in many respects, liberalizing things, so it's sort of like the reason Asia and the U.S., I think, are going to pass, and this is what Jim Rogers is predicting, is that a lot of these countries are starting at such a low level of economic freedom that even as they grant their people just little crumbs in terms of the rate of their GDP growth and, you know, how much capital is going to flow in there once investors think, oh, we're not going to be expropriated, okay, that you're going to see these huge gains as these countries catch up to the West. Whereas with the West, we're moving in the wrong direction. That we had a relatively free market economy, and they just keep laying more and more regulations on it. So like in China, things in the last few years are like, my understanding is they were allowing peasants who had, you know, little plots of land from the, back in the days of when it was complete socialism, that now they're allowed to like sort of sell the rights to use that to outside you know, agribusiness, so that they can come in and buy up the rights to thousands of adjacent parcels of land and just do large-scale industrial agriculture, as opposed to having a bunch of little people run, you know, just having their little farm or little gardens or whatever, right? So things like that, that it's not that in absolute terms they're going to necessarily have a freer economy than we will, but they're going to be freer than they were 5 years ago. And so that's why they're going to be growing relatively quickly compared to the West, which is going the wrong way. Okay, Chris Bellchamber says, oh, but just to finish that train of thought, like I said, the people that were telling investors to go into these countries and that they were going to be hot sources of growth and you want to get into an ETF that's exposed to Southeast Asian stocks and blah, 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 the people making those analyses were looking solely at taxing and like spending and stuff like that, like fiscal issues. They were not concerned with monetary policy. So I think you're right to be worried about that, and you would want to, before you pick a particular country and thought, oh, I'm putting my wealth in that country because they have low tariff barriers and, you know, and not many, you know, not high taxes on capital or something. But you're right. If their currency is tied to the dollar or something and you think the dollar is going to crash, you might want to think twice. Okay, Chris Bellchamber says, I would be very grateful for more Austrian economic responses to many social issues. This could lead to a much greater ability to negotiate with the many status quo rationalizations, which could lead to very suboptimal actions. For example, on the environment, which I accept is based on a great deal of highly questionable science, and science is in quotation marks, there is very little Austrian economic response. Okay. I'm not going to do it right now, Chris, because I don't want to get tied up here, but I'll come back and post. I've written a few things on this, and then I'll try to give you links to others. So I see one guy has pointed you to Roy Cordato, who's good, but I've written specifically on some of this stuff, so I'll point you to my stuff and then also just some other general sort of. So you are right, Chris, that typically the free market libertarian response to, for example, suggestions that impose a carbon tax or cap and trade because of climate change issues, the typical libertarian response has been to attack the science. And I think that's dangerous because that sort of leaves the door open to say, well, if these scientific claims just so happen to be true, then are you saying a carbon tax would be a good idea? Most libertarians don't think that that's right. And the other thing, of course, too, is most of us aren't actual climate scientists. So we're sort of out of our realm of expertise when we're trying to evaluate these claims. So in my own work, I've tried to separate those two things and to say, let's stipulate the science for the sake of argument. Does it follow that a carbon tax is a good idea? Or another interesting thing is to say, in a completely Rothbardian world, suppose it really were the case that emitting carbon dioxide is going to kill everybody in 50 years, what private market mechanisms would evolve to deal with that? Or would we just be sitting ducks? And that's, you know, a flaw in the Rothbardian approach, is that if there happened to be some global issue like that, externality, that we'd all be dead. And so, to end your suspense, I don't think we'd all be dead. I've written a paper on how would private legal systems deal with that, how would property rights evolve to take that sort of thing into account without needing a monopoly government to come along and just solve it by fiat. Okay, but I will, like I said, I'll come back and post on that and give you those links. Okay, Michael Arnold says, in your estimation, which countries or market sectors will be least affected by a Weimar-style collapse of the dollar? In other words, which countries or markets most closely follow Austrian economic principles? Boy. Well, the country thing, for one thing, I'm not as up to speed with other countries as I am with the U.S. situation, so I don't want to comment on that right now. Let me just say, in a commercial, we're going to be rolling out, it might even already be posted, but for sure by Monday we're going to announce, I'm doing a crash course, a four-week thing on the sovereign debt crisis, so like the Eurozone, what's going on with the pig countries, that kind of thing. So I'll get more specific there if you guys are interested in that issue. But for tonight's sort of conference call right now, or webinar, I don't want to talk about foreign countries because I don't have those facts quite at my fingertips, and I want to say something wrong. But let me just warn you, it is tricky to speculate on foreign currencies, okay? That they do things, they're, how can I put it? It's not enough to be a good economist to be a good investor. That if you're going to do something, I mean, knowledge of Austrian economics and knowledge of Austrian business cycle theory and monetary theory, I think, can give you an idea of the broad trends that are going to happen over the next decade. And so if you want to just position yourself and just ride the thing out and be willing to wait 10 years, that might be something. But like I'm just saying, your question, like, I think no matter what country you pick, even if it looked good on paper, I mean, some crazy thing could happen and its currency might fall 20% in a day, just because there's, you know, you'd have to research what did the banks do and what, you know what I mean? So even, the reason I'm saying it is I know a bunch of free market guys, and one of them, you know, he was really big on Iceland, that he thought Iceland was a shining success story, and there were, you know, and he wasn't nuts, there were plenty of, you know, not Austrian necessarily, but free market think tank publications touting the successful government reforms in Iceland and why this was a great model for what the rest of the world should do and things like that. I think like they reformed their tax code, and there were a lot of reasons on paper that you might have thought Iceland was a great place to put your wealth, and that, you know, their currency was strong, and you know what happened. Okay, so, and the same thing like with Ireland, again, not necessarily the Austrians, but a lot of free market people were praising Ireland for reforming their tax code, you know, implementing austerity measures a while back and turning around their debt to GDP and everything, and they were held up as a shining success story, and of course, now nobody's pointing to them and saying that's what we should do. So it's, my point is there's so many moving parts, and if one little thing goes wrong and investors dump that currency, you can get killed if you, you know, we're speculating on that. So I'm cautioning you, like your question itself, you might want to be careful on how you're approaching this issue. Having said all that, in market sectors, let me, again, I'm not telling you guys to go put your money here, okay? I'm just giving you things to think about. If I'm right and the economy is going to be awful, well, I probably am not personally going to go open up a bunch of luxury condos. I don't think the demand for that's going to be real. I'm not going to open a high-end jewelry store in the mall. But somebody, you know, who was thinking about buying a bunch of, you know, what do you call it, low-income rental units, that might work, that kind of thing. Hang on, I just got pinged. Okay. Danny says, by the way, that the link to that four-week sovereign debt crisis course he just posted in the public chat, if you guys are curious about the details. All right, so here's the thing, though. What I just talked about was the general economic conditions that, to the extent that we're going to be in this recession. Because the thing is, when things are really awful, as they've been, and I think they're going to continue to be, even people who have money aren't going to want to be ostentatious about it, because they're going to feel guilty. Right? So, you know, people might not want to go to some steakhouse where you just eat until you're going to explode and then get rolled out to your Mercedes, because they're going to just feel bad driving by a bunch of beggars and stuff on the way home. So that's the kind of thing I mean, is thinking through those sorts of things that may be obvious. As far as you're asking about the monetary issue, I mean, I'm just saying obvious stuff here, but like, you know, mining stocks and stuff like that, to the extent that, look at the things that people go into is inflation hedges. And a lot of that stuff you can do research yourself, I think, and just go look at, like, look in the late 1970s and try to get disaggregated stock market data. And you can see which sectors outperformed the market as a whole and so forth. You do stuff like that. But in terms of your question too, like which countries or markets most closely follow Austrian principles, it's really tricky. I mean, there are plenty of places that have pretty sensible tax reform, and so you could say they're following good supply side stuff, but I don't know off the top of my head of any place that, you know, is, I don't understand why this isn't happening. I don't see why some country somewhere doesn't just say, okay, we're tying our currency, tying it to gold, that we're not using the dollar, we're using gold. I mean, maybe because they think they would get invaded. I'm only saying that half jokingly. I don't know why they don't do that. But, you know, Russia, 2 years ago, I think, their president had a press conference and held up a gold coin and said, this is the future, not the dollar, and then I haven't heard anything else about that. So I don't, maybe they're just getting their ducks in a row before they go ahead and do that and dump the dollar. I'm not sure. But I think that will be the real key. If the euro collapses and then maybe the dollar goes down, presumably some country is going to emerge from the rubble and tie their currency to gold. And then I would say in that environment, obviously, that currency's got a much better future than the other fiat currencies. But thus far, off the top of my head, I can't point you to any country and say, yes, those guys are doing a good job in terms of monetary policy. Okay, Hugo Schultz says, with the S&P downgrade of U.S. debt, and more significantly, the huge looming funding requirements of that debt, why have interest rates on U.S. debt gone down, whereas interest rates on other countries downgraded debt, such as Greece, have gone up? It's a great question, so in case you guys don't understand what he's asking, you may have thought that U.S. bonds were getting crushed since S&P downgraded it. So S&P recently took, Treasury debt, it used to be AAA, and now it's AA+, which is just, one notch below AAA. So, and that happened right when this market volatility started, and so a lot of people think this is all about the downgrade, but people on the other side are saying, well, wait a minute, not necessarily, because, as Hugo's alluding to here, people have not been rushing out of U.S. treasuries. There hasn't been a massive selling of them, and so, yeah, the U.S. stock market's been getting crushed, but bonds haven't been getting crushed. So what's going on there? Whereas in some of these countries like Greece and Italy and so, like, you did see when investors got worried about default on their bonds, as you would have expected, the yields went way up on them. The credit default swap premium went up, like, so how much you have to pay a third party to insure you and take that bond default. Those premiums went way up. So I think, I mean, there's many things going on, Hugo. One thing is, I don't think the recent turmoil has just been about the S&P downgrade. I think a lot of it was due to people, after the U.S. debt deal was done, people looked back over at Europe and said, holy cow, things have been deteriorating over there while we've been arguing with, watching the Republicans and Democrats argue over the debt ceiling. Also, in the grand scheme, to have a AA+ rating doesn't mean you're about to default. So I don't think many investors believe the U.S. is going to default anytime soon. I think it's just more they know there's this long-term problem. And also, I think most investors believe the way the U.S. is going to default is by printing money. That they don't believe the Treasury is going to literally tell investors, we can't pay you. That what they may do is just print off a bunch of money, through various indirect mechanisms, and pay people off in worthless dollars, or dollars that are worth less than they may have thought they were going to be when they lent the government the money. Okay. Hans says, sir, as long as debt is used as money, I see two opposing forces fighting each other right now. Debt default / deleveraging on the one hand, creating a deflationary pressure on prices, and two, frenetic Fed policy trying to create inflation by expanding the money supply. Can we be sure the Fed has the political power to go through with enough inflation to create the dreaded inflationary depression free market economists have been warning about? Okay, that's a great question. So what he's talking about, just to make sure everyone's on the same page here, is in our insane system right now, there's a very real sense in which our money is based on debt. So if the Fed wants to inject new reserves into the system, typically what it does is it buys treasury bonds. And, it takes them onto its balance sheet and then creates new money out of thin air with which to buy those bonds. So there, that means like the new injections of reserves go hand in hand with taking treasury debt and putting it on the books of the Fed. And so it's like for every new dollar that's out there in existence, you can point to treasury debt that stands behind it. And then there's also the fact that when the commercial banks inflate, how do they do that? Well, as long as they have enough excess reserves, let's say someone comes up and applies for a mortgage, and the bank, the loan officer says, yeah, this is a good risk, let's go ahead and do that. For all intents and purposes, the commercial bank just creates that money out of thin air too, and they say, okay, here you go, we're going to give you $300,000 to go buy that house, so now you have $300,000 in your checking account, as it were, to go write a check for the house. But you, of course, now sign this note and you have a 30-year mortgage with us. So that money creation there is, in a sense, you know, mirrors the mortgage that that homeowner now owes to the bank. And so there is a large degree of truth to saying if the U.S. paid off all its debts, and this is true in other countries too, because your other countries' systems are the same way, but if private Americans paid off all their debt, so they didn't owe the banks any money, they didn't owe credit cards, they didn't owe anybody any money, and the Treasury paid off all its debt, the actual money supply would be much smaller when the smoke cleared. And so that would be very deflationary. Okay, so that's what Hans is talking about. So there's something going on here, though, Hans, just to make you aware. It depends on how that debt gets liquidated, whether it's deflationary or not. So if a commercial bank creates $300,000, or let's say creates $250,000 because it had some in reserve, and gives me a $300,000 loan, and I sign the mortgage, and I go buy a house, and then the market collapses and the house is only worth $100,000 and I default, that $300,000 is still out there. That's still out there in M1. That doesn't shrink. All that shrinks is the bank on its balance sheet, and in terms of its assets, that mortgage that I owed it, now they have to write it down, or, you know, just get rid of it. If I just say, you know what, you never see another penny out of me, then they just completely write it off. So that hurts their capital, that hurts their shareholder equity, but their liabilities don't go down. Because when I wrote that check to the person who sold the house, they went and deposited it. I mean, that money now is out there. So it's true, the bank that has to write off that mortgage is going to be less willing to extend new loans to people. So the engine of money creation stalls, but I'm just pointing out it's a little bit more subtle than maybe you're thinking, that if somebody just defaults on a debt, that by itself isn't deflationary. The only reason it's deflationary is that if it wrecks the creditor's balance sheet, then the creditor is less likely to engage in more inflationary lending until they repair their balance sheet. Okay, so as far as your question, yeah, you've got these forces. People are trying to pay off their debts. In and of itself, that's deflationary, given our current messed up system, while the Fed's inflating. You're right, it's a matter of political will. All right, so a lot of people argue that the Fed is incapable of inflating. I've seen a lot of people say to me in conferences, or people email me and ask me, and they seem to have the idea that Bernanke is literally powerless to cause massive rise in prices while we've got the deleveraging cycle going on. And I think that's patently false. Bernanke, if he wanted to, could create $250 billion next Tuesday. Now, would he do that? Presumably not. And I was actually, my own view as to how nuts is Bernanke, I'm not sure. Because I was ready to tell you guys, you know, I was waiting for this week's Fed announcement, if they launched QE3 officially, and they said, yeah, we're going to go buy another $800 billion of treasuries or whatever they would have said, or, you know, or even worse, if they said we're going to buy euro-denominated debt from, you know, Portugal and Spain and Italy and whatever, then, I mean, I would have said, holy cow, run for the hills. This is going to blow up pretty quickly. But they didn't say that. They said we're going to, you know, hold pat, we're just going to keep rolling over our current investments, maintain the size of our balance sheet. And the only thing they really did was they gave specificity to the current interest rate policy stance. They said we're going to hold it this level until mid-2013, which is unprecedented for the Fed to promise people that much in advance of how long they're going to keep interest rates low. So, yeah, they're going to have to inflate to maintain that target, but that's different from them saying at the outset, we're going to go buy another $800 billion of assets or whatever the number may have been. So I'm not sure, Hans. I wish I could give you a better answer. I cannot figure out what Bernanke's doing. What is clear is Bernanke is not a member of some school of thought in implementing their recommendations, right? So the Keynesians think Bernanke should do more. The quasi-monetarists think Bernanke should do more. The Austrians think he's done way too much already. So there's nobody out there has a model that can explain what the heck Bernanke has been doing. And so that's why I and others think he's doing what the bankers want him to do. He's not doing what's good for the economy. So it's not just that he's misguided and using the wrong rule book. I think he doesn't believe the stuff he's saying. He knows what the policies are going to be because that's what's going to benefit the big bankers. And then he has to come up with some excuse to justify what he's doing that week compared to last week. So, but given that, it's really hard to predict what he's going to do in the future because, you know, is it in the banker's interest for the dollar to actually fall? I don't know. I mean, if they wanted to implement a regional currency like the euro, then it would be. But maybe now they're looking at the eurozone collapsing and thinking, oh, maybe we don't want to get rid of the dollar and have an euro. You know, maybe we want to back off that. So I don't know. See, but so it's, I think the way you anticipate that stuff is try to figure, put yourself in the shoes of a major banker who, you know, runs a global bank, and then ask yourself what policies that the Fed would do would I want to benefit me, and that's probably what Bernanke is going to do over the next few years. Okay, Ricardo says, could you respond to Ms. Shedlock's criticism of the views of various economic factions on inflation and deflation? Well, I already have done that. I don't know if you're familiar. If you go to my archives, this was a while ago, but I have an article called Mitch Should Ditch His Deflation Fears, something like that. And then I have a more recent one. I can't remember the exact title, but I mean, it should have Mitch in the title, where I go through, because Mitch has been claiming that he's been calling all these trends, because he says, yeah, I'm a deflationist, but I also think gold is money. And so he said, I've called everything perfectly, that I knew we were going to have general, you know, sluggishness and CPI and whatever, but I also knew gold was going to go to the roof. And so I went through to try to say, no, you didn't, Mitch. That, you know, and I just went through and documented that he did not see the commodity boom coming. So, yeah, he may have called gold, but he didn't call oil and things like that. So that was, and then also just the his theoretical framework, the way he explains what he means by credit inflation and deflation, I had some trouble with that, and so I pointed that out in my most recent article. So when I come back to this after we're done here, I'll get to it by tomorrow, by Saturday, I'll try to post the exact links so you know what I'm talking about, but I already have written up two things at least responding to Mitch. Okay, let me just see how many questions we got. Okay, so I'm going to go a little bit faster here to try to make sure I get through everyone's questions. We got about 10 minutes. I can bleed over a little bit since I went long on the initial PowerPoint deal. Okay, Mark Hamilton says, as we all know, the Fed raised the Fed funds rate in the early 80s, and this lowered inflation and also male investments. Is it possible that today, even with the Fed funds rate at about zero, that banks are refusing to lend, so increasing their reserves and having the same effect as raising the Fed funds rate, even with all the quantitative easing? This seems to me the one thing that could blindside Austrians who aren't looking at that reserve-to-loan percentage. Unfortunately, I'm a very amateur economist, and I've searched long and hard for data on current reserve-to-loan percentage and can't find it. If you have any suggestions, many thanks for what you do. Well, I'm not sure if this is what you're asking, but I mean, right now, the banks are more than 100% reserved. Like they can fully back up all their customer deposits because Bernanke can give them so much of new reserves. If you're asking me what would happen if the Fed came along and raised reserve requirements, so instead of the roughly, it's not actually 10%, it depends on the type of account you have, what the percentages. But if you're saying, what if the Fed doesn't raise interest rates, but what if they say to banks, okay, instead of having 10% reserves, you got to have 20% reserves. That would certainly constrain the bank's ability to inflate, or especially if the Fed said you need to have 100% reserves, whatever. But that would absolutely crush the banking sector. So I don't think the Fed's going to do that. So if you look at, in my archives, there's an article, something like Ron Paul's proposal to cancel the Fed Treasury debt or something like that. It's a fairly recent article. I walk through this and just explain. I use the analogy. let's say you have $1,000 in your checking account, and then the Fed comes, or the government comes along and says, we are now making it a crime. It is illegal for anyone to let his checking account balance fall below $500. If we catch you with your checking account balance less than $500, you know, we're going to throw you in jail for a year. Well, what does that do to your savings? Yesterday, you thought you had $1,000 in your checking account. Now, effectively, you only have $500 in there because the first $500 you can't even use. So it's as if you don't have it because of that new regulation. So by the same token, the banks right now thinking they have $1.6 trillion in excess reserves. If the Fed comes along and slaps on 100% reserve requirement, that's like just taking that money away from the banks. So maybe you think that's a good thing, and perhaps that's ethically justified given how screwed up our system is. I'm not saying it would be bad if the Fed did that. What I'm saying is that would be equivalent from the bank's point of view to the Fed just seizing their reserves and just taking $1.6 trillion from them and saying, okay, now how are you guys doing? What are your business prospects like now? What are you going to say your next annual or quarterly report to your investors that we just took $1.6 trillion from you? So that's what I mean. It would have just undone the whole point of Bernanke inflating in the first place. Because remember, Bernanke did all that stuff to bail out the bankers. That was not, I mean, if the point was actually to do the stuff he claimed he was doing, like trying to resuscitate lending and trying to make sure businesses, small businesses could meet their payroll and trying to get the credit markets flowing and all that, they wouldn't have given these targeted secret bailouts to huge banks. They would have just basically showered money on the economy in general. So I don't see Bernanke raising reserve requirements very steeply because that would crush the banks. And like I say, the one constant in all this to make sense of what Bernanke has been doing is it helps the banks. Mahesh, I'll try to, when I come back to this, Mark, I'll try to give you links so you can go look at the stuff you want, but off the top of my head, I'm not going to take time to do it right now because it would waste too much time. Okay, Mahesh says, Dr. Murphy, am I correct in assuming that a zero federal funds rate means that the incentive for savings and thus investment in capital is also zero? Also, would a zero Fed funds rate imply that the profit margins in all orders of production tend to zero? Okay. You're on the right track. I mean, strictly speaking, no, because there's a couple things. One is not all interest rates are zero right now. It's just the federal funds rate, and even that isn't literally zero. It's in between zero and 0.25%. But other interest rates, especially like for corporate bonds, are not zero. And the further out you go on the yield curve, the rates are higher. Right? So if you're going to lend money out for 5 years to a corporation, you're going to get more than a 0% annual return on that. You ask, does it push, is there no incentive for saving anymore? Well, there's less of incentive, but there's still an incentive. Right? So households, if you look at the household saving data, I'm going to have an article coming out Monday at Mises.org on this, on deleveraging, and I have some charts showing what household saving behavior has been like. Households are saving a lot more now than they were during the housing bubble years. And that's not a contradiction, because you might say, wait a minute, but interest rates right now are so low, why are people saving more? Because they realize how deeply they are in debt, and so they're trying to dig out of that. So even if interest rates are zero, if you think that you're carrying way too much credit card debt, and of course credit card interest rates aren't zero, but even if your interest rate on your debt is zero and you're just carrying way too much debt relative to your income, you might rationally start paying that off, which means you're saving, even though you would do it more quickly if interest rates were higher. Or even if you weren't in debt, but you just wanted to build your assets, in this environment, everybody panicked and they think, okay, let's not be reckless. Instead of me going and buying a Ferrari, I'm going to buy whatever, a Lincoln Town Car, and use the difference and go put it in bonds or something, because this is such a messed up economy. I don't know what the future is going to hold, and so I want to keep my wealth very liquid, and I want to save a lot. Even though the return on that saving is negligible, even so, a lot of people are panicked and just, you know, that people are stockpiling cash, which earns no rate of return. Which, you know, it's actually a negative real rate of return. The prices are rising, but a lot of people say, yeah, I don't care. I want to be very liquid. So I'm going to save, you know, postpone consumption, just build up really liquid stuff, even literal cash, because I don't know what the future's going to bring. So there's nothing illogical about that, but you're right. If Bernanke let interest rates go to where the market level would be, there would be even more savings, because that's what the economy needs right now, so that's what the interest rate would be guiding them to do, and Bernanke is partially neutralizing that healthy response. Jerry Chang says, is the current U.S. economic status comparable to Japan in its 20 years ago, and what do I consider the role of excess reserves playing? All right, so I already talked about the excess reserves. As far as the comparison to Japan, there are some similarities, and I think that's why a lot of investors aren't predicting massive price inflation, because they look at Japan and they say, well, in Japan, they bumped up their monetary base pretty significantly for a while there, and Japan's had falling consumer prices or flat for 20 years, and their stock market's still not nowhere near where it was at its height. And so, you Austrians are crazy. Well, there's a couple things. One is, if you look at the Japanese monetary base, what they did there, yeah, they pumped it up maybe like 22% or so at its peak in terms of an annual rise. But then once price inflation started going positive, they sucked it right back out. All right, so Bernanke has not done that yet. So first of all, Bernanke has inflated way more than the Japanese ever did in terms of percentages in time frame. And secondly, Bernanke has yet to suck any of that base out. So in prices right now, I showed you in that chart in the presentation, consumer prices are rising at a 3% clip, even with the official numbers. In Japan, once price inflation turned positive, the Bank of Japan started shrinking its balance sheet and sucking reserves out of the system. Okay, so the Bank of Japan officials were a lot bigger hawks than the Fed is right now. So, yeah, if Bernanke shrinks the Fed balance sheet by 10% over the next year in order to get CPI growth back to being zero, then I'll start saying, okay, maybe we're in store for a replay of what Japan just went through. But so far, Bernanke has not done that. He keeps pumping in money or holding pat, even though prices are rising at 3% plus, even the consumer level, according to government's own bogus numbers. Okay, Cecile says, could you please explain the underlying issue of what the recent debt ceiling debate was really about? It seems like the stalemate in Congress, which brought about a downgrade, was not about authorizing an increase in the U.S.'s ability to add new debt. I'd like to understand how the debate relates to the current state of the economy and what an Austrian perspective would be on the issues that were at the center of the debate. Okay. Well, I think you're right. I mean, the reason that was such a big deal, it was not over some technical issue of the debt. I mean, the debt ceiling has been raised, I'm forget what the exact number is, 70 times or something since it was first implemented in World War I. So why was it such a big deal? Well, it's because of politics. And I think the Republicans knew they had a good issue here, and they thought the public was with them. And the Republicans really want to hang this economy around Barack Obama's neck. The Republicans want to go into the next election with everyone thinking the Democrats and Obama are just drunken sailors running up huge debts, and that's why you need to elect a conservative Republican in the office to get the spending under control. So that's what they were trying to jockey for. The Republicans do not care about the fiscal situation, or at least the mainstream establishment Republicans don't care. Why do I say that with such confidence? Because if they didn't raise the debt ceiling, then by definition, we had a balanced budget amendment, right? The government was prohibited from borrowing any more money. They could not increase. They had to run a balanced budget from that point forward. That was what the status quo was. And the Republicans, in their deal, agreed, okay, we're going to let you guys borrow another $2 trillion, but only if you promise to do these things like having a balanced budget amendment process and all this stuff and having sharp stuff. You know, don't believe mainstream Republicans when they say we want a balanced budget. They had that and they gave it up. that all they needed to do was nothing, and you would have had a balanced budget by default. As far as, you know, the Austrian issue, I mean, it's the big thing, I think, from an Austrian perspective, it's not the debt per se, it's total government spending. So if the government's going to spend $4 trillion, that right there is an indication of how many real resources from the private sector are getting diverted into political channels. And so those resources are being directed out of private hands and into areas where the politicians want the resources to go. So that's inefficient, immoral, whatever you want to call it. The issue is, so what's special about debt? Well, the reason you might, for political economy purposes, the reason you might favor having, you know, a balanced budget requirement is that it constrains the government because the public doesn't like to be taxed. So if the government is only allowed to spend that which it takes in through explicit tax revenue year to year, that's probably going to mean the government spends less than if you allow it to borrow money. So that's why I think from an Austrian perspective you would be against government deficits, not because you'd rather the government raise taxes and get the revenue that way, but just because deficits seem like a less painful way for the government to spend, when really economically, anytime the government spends, that's diverting resources out of private hands into the government's hands. The other thing too is, I think the public, for understandable reasons, is more likely to approve of a given government tax and expenditure if it's to pay off bondholders than if it's to just fund some new boondoggle. And so to the extent that the government over time keeps running massive deficits and building up this huge debt that it needs to service out of tax revenue, it gets harder to slash that spending. In other words, the public, if they get more libertarian, read Rothbard or whatever, the public might be, you might sell them more easily on slashing $200 billion from the defense budget or from food stamps or from, you know, the Department of Education or whatever. You might get them to agree to a $200 billion cut there, whereas to say, why do we keep spending $200 billion worth of interest payments to all these bondholders? Let's just stop doing that and save money. The public would probably feel like, well, then we just rip those people off. Like, they lent us money, we should pay them back. Whereas they might not think that a defense contractor is owed the money that he thought he was going to get in next year's budget. So that's another danger of letting the government run up these debts, is it makes the public more likely to agree that, oh yeah, the federal government ought to be paying all this money in the future that it gets out of tax revenue. Because it seems like paying off a debt is a more honorable thing than just spending on new programs. Okay, Matthew Farley, and so we're going to wrap it up in about the next 5 minutes here, guys. Let me just say, I'm going to refresh this page, because I'm looking at this forum as it was a half an hour ago when I started, or an hour ago when I started the lecture. So if you posted while I was talking, I'm not seeing it, and we're going to run out of time here, but I will answer, you know, typing it in by tomorrow, by Saturday afternoon, I will go ahead and answer all these things if I'm not getting your question now during the live Q&A. Matthew Farley says, Dr. Murphy, what effect do you think a global economic collapse will have on the current distribution of geopolitical power? In other words, which countries or groups of people will obtain or retain the greatest influence over world politics should an economic collapse occur? Well, I'm not Tom Clancy or anything, so I don't claim to be an expert in this, but I kind of have to think the people, the ruling elite in China are just kind of sitting back saying, let's just let this thing ride out. In another 10 years, we're going to be on top. Not that they're going to be able to run the world, but that the U.S. certainly won't be able to run the world 10 years from now. That they can just see the way our political system works, that, you know, we need to be turning on a dime, and we're not. And so I think they can just see, yeah, let's just, you know, we don't need to do anything. We don't need to openly confront the U.S. military. Let's just bide our time, and, you know, we don't have to face the same sort of election pressures that these guys do, you know, these morons running for office in the United States. I mean, it's got to be laughable to them. And then they're just sitting back and saying, we can wait. You know, we're trying to build up real commodities. We're, you know, we're investing. You know, we have trade surpluses that we're putting into various commodities and things. We've got a huge stockpile of dollars. and just to show that, you know, we, whatever the U.S. dollar does, if it does well, we're fine, and if not, well, we're going to take a loss, but we're going to be better off than the U.S. So I think that that's, they're certainly going to be the dominant power if I had to pick one. And so here, you know, I think, what's his name, Jim Rogers is right when he says the 19th century was the British century, the 20th century was the U.S. century, and the 21st one is Asia generally and China specifically. I think that's right. If you had to guess now. Nathan Stewart says, do you agree with Bob Wenzel's prediction that recent Fed efforts to expand the money supply will result in another manipulated boom and therefore even higher prices? So for those of you who don't know, Bob Wenzel is, he runs economicpolicyjournal.com. So it's an interesting website. He follows daily financial events. And, you know, blogs about them in real time and does a lot of investigative reporting, if you will, like looking into, you know, who actually was behind this corrupt deal with the Fed and Bank of America and blah, blah, blah. So he does a lot of digging. It's not just academic stuff. It's real world gossip almost at times. But the cool thing is he's an Austrian, right? He's read a lot of the theory. He met Murray Rothbard a couple times. He's been to the Mises Institute. I mean, so he is academically, intellectually, an Austrian economist, but yet his day job is to be a blogger about the financial market. So it's a pretty interesting site. Again, it's economicpolicyjournal.com if you want to check that out. I don't get a commission, but just point you to that. So Nathan's asking, what Wenzel has been saying recently is that if you look at M1 and M2, those things have been growing pretty quickly recently in terms of the annualized growth rates. So Wenzel is saying he expects a turnaround in the stock market. He expects the unemployment numbers will look better and the economy will appear to be doing well, but it's a manipulated boom. I'm not so sure. It's, I get what Wenzel is saying, but I think right now we're in a boom. In other words, I think the economy was so bad in the fall of 2008 that if the Fed had sat back and done nothing, it really would have been called the next Great Depression for about 18 months. And then we would have been, you know, the market would have purged all the rottenness out of the system, to use that allegedly horrendous phrase that Andrew Mellon did, but I think it's fine. That's what does need to happen. You want to leave the rottenness in the system? Why wouldn't you want to purge the rottenness out of the system? So I think that would have been bad. It would have flushed all those male investments out. A bunch of investment banks would have gone under, but the economy would have emerged 18 months later very nimble and with the ability to grow. And so what we've had in the meantime, I think, is just a completely bogus recovery that just building us up on a house of cards. So I actually do think we've been in the manipulated boom all along. It's just the baseline was so awful that it doesn't feel like we're in prosperity. So that's my pretty pessimistic view. So it's not that I'm expecting unemployment to all of a sudden go down to 7% anytime soon. It wouldn't surprise me if unemployment bounces around officially 8, 9% or 10% for years to come, because why would anybody create jobs in the private sector right now with all the uncertainty, knowing your taxes are going to have to go up to pay for all this stuff and being worried that the dollar is going to crash? Okay, well, let me stop on that pessimistic note, but again, I want to remind you guys, even though we are pessimistic, it's all relative. In absolute terms, we still are fantastically wealthy. You're going to be much richer than your parents were just because of all the cool things that capitalism is producing. So just try not to get locked up in Guantanamo. And again, I'm going to, if I didn't answer your specific question or if I addressed it but told you I'd get back to you, I will try to do all that by tomorrow, Saturday. You know, you guys will have access to the Moodle forum there. And thank you, everyone, for participating in this first Mises webinar. I hope you guys learned some stuff. I hope I didn't drive you all to drink. Don't go jumping off any bridges. And I will just keep reading Mises.org. And remember, if you don't know what to do with your money, send it to the Mises Institute. But that's not official investment advice.